Me.
Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this,
I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Live Nation presents Concert Week. Now through May 14th, get $25 tickets to over 5,000 shows. That's up to 75% off a summer full of your favorite artists like 21 Savage, Alanis Morissette, Cage the Elephant, Celeste Barber, Dierks Bentley, Fade, Hootie and the Blowfish, Janet Jackson, Kidz Bop Kids, Meghan Trainor, Bissell Pluma, Sarah McLachlan. Get tickets to more than 5,000 summer shows for just $25. Until now through May 14th. Visit LiveNation.com/Concert Week to learn more and plan your summer with Sean Paul, Sum 41, 30 Seconds to Mars, oh, and Two Door Cinema Club.
Cool Zone Media.
Hello, and welcome to Cool People Did Cool Stuff, your podcast. It's yours. It belongs to you. Because it's part of the commons. You see what I did there? If you didn't listen to part one, you have no idea what I'm talking about. But you might know my guest, Robert Evans, from
That's right.
Mind of Asterix.
Yes, and I legally own all podcasts, actually. I came up with the idea. Before me, no one had ever had the idea to steal the human voice and imprison it in an audio file. You know, I invented that.
Yeah. The first wax cylinder, Robert Evans special.
That's right. That's right. It's audio of me drunkenly trying to order Pizza Hut.
Our producer is Sophie.
Everything Robert says is a lie. Everything Margaret says is the truth.
Is it like with the two guards waiting at the pass?
Yeah. If podcasting ever doesn't work out, you and I could get a gig doing that, guarding some rich guy's dungeon.
I'd look good in a suit of full plate armor with a halberd, just saying. You know how they have the, like, every now and then the internet figures out that some Victorian rich people had had like hermits that they hired to like live on their property. The new one should be the ominous guards.
The ominous guards, one of whom tells only lies and the other speaks the truth.
And ominously guarding our legal liability by cutting out when we say things we shouldn't is our audio engineer, Danil. Hi, Danil.
Yeah.
Hi, Danil. Robert, fucking say it.
Hi, Danil.
Okay, good. And our theme music was written for us by Un Woman. And this is part two in a two-parter about the Luddites. And I wonder if there's people who actually only listen to part two of mine because they know the first part is context, but you're going to miss so much and you won't understand why it's cool if you don't go back and listen to part one. There's poetry and fire. So, the Luddites. I mentioned that there was a war going on in Europe, the Napoleonic Wars, and this was fucking everything up, as war tends to do. It was fucking up industry and the economy and food and all of that shit. It didn't help that you also get like 4 years of bad harvests in a row. And there's a fucking comet in the sky and everyone you know is dying in Europe fighting a Napoleon. And trade embargoes are cutting off entire markets for textile exports, which is 10% of what the British people do for work. Food prices are rising dramatically. People are living, literally starving in a lot of these working class towns. And all of these fucking factories are suddenly popping up everywhere, and trade unionism is outlawed. And we do and don't know a lot about the Luddites. There are endless well-researched books written about them, and there are plenty of primary sources because they weren't afraid to write. But they were also a secret society, and they took their vow of secrecy really seriously. A lot of what we know only came out decades later as old Luddites approach the end of their lives. And it's like the 1860s. And they're like, all right, fine. I guess I can fucking talk about that shit, you know?
Yeah.
So not the best way to get super accurate information. They're also such mythic figures that everyone tries to write a story onto them. I'm honestly doing it too. I'm trying not to, right? But it's impossible. But we do know a lot of their actions. The Luddites weren't all over England. They were in what gets called the Luddite Triangle, which should have been called the Ludic Triangle, if you ask me, but no one did because I wasn't born, and Ludic might have a different etymological root. There was a triangle formed by Yorkshire in the north, west to Lancashire, and down to Leicestershire.
Leicester. I know that because I've pronounced it wrong on the show, and everyone in England is like, how did you not guess that it's pronounced completely differently from how it's spelled?
But it's Leicestershire.
You have it spelled out.
Leicestershire?
It's Leicestershire.
Because they're the different, the bigger areas have the shire at the end, and then the towns.
Look.
Like there's like Nottingham, and then it's in Nottinghamshire.
Nottinghamshire. Get your shit together, England. Come on.
I know. Well, they're still fighting giants, so it's like hard, you know?
Did you say get your shit together, England?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The one thing we don't want them to do.
Yeah, you're right. The last time that happened, it went badly for a lot of people.
When Albion rises, we're all in trouble.
Keep your shit apart.
Yeah. Some of us, actually, that's the next line of my script. Some of us don't know a lot about England. Say, for example, all you know about England is that King Uther Pendragon once died while his heir was missing and his son Arthur was discovered by pulling a sword out of a stone. And the same thing is about to happen now because, get it, there's a, I'm trying to make a reference to things that are happening in the modern world and in the news. Sophie, are you impressed?
Are you talking about the fact that nobody's seen Princess Kate Middleton in many months and the Photoshop fail and that the royal family is not explaining why?
Yes, which I knew about because of you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Whereas if you want to know about kings who either never existed or have been dead for 500 years, I'm your girl. But things that actually impact our lives now, so versed with.
This does not impact our lives, but...
That's good.
Kate Middleton may not be alive, which is not good.
Unless by the time you're hearing this, she has returned with Excalibur and has gone to the Isle of Avalon and talked to the ladies there to get a sword from the Lady in the Lake.
Or, if you follow conspiracy theories, with a brand new face.
Ooh. I hope there's still a sword.
Me too. Should always be a sword.
Yeah.
The other thing that you might know about England is that there was a fox named Robin Hood who hung out in a forest called Sherwood robbing people alongside his buddy who was a bear named Little John. For those of us who don't know anything beyond that, the Ludic Triangle included Nottingham in Nottinghamshire and therefore Sherwood Forest. In fact, our story starts in Nottingham.
Okay.
I'm going to claim it started in November 1811. Other people are like, oh, it was in March, but there was like some specific characteristics that made it. Some people did some cool shit in March, but I'm going to start it in November.
Sure.
Because this is when it is more self-consciously the Luddites. On November 4th, 1811, on a night lit by the comet in Nottingham, a small band of men, more women are involved later, or were written out of this earlier part, because everything keeps being like, and then these men did things, and like later in the story, they're like, and there's some women. And you're like, were they there all along?
Yeah, who's to know, you know? Yeah.
But a small group of people gathered and disguised themselves. Some of them blackened their faces with coal, others covered their faces with scarves. They are armed with hammers, axes, and pistols. They make their way to a weaver's studio, not quite a factory, but a place where machines for knitting hosiery are being worked. And they go in and they only smash up not all the frames, but the wide frames. These are the frames that make cheap, inferior product at like greater speeds. A week after the first November raid, they went at it again. This time, the owner was ready. One Luddite died, and he shouted out, "Proceed, my brave fellows, I die with a willing heart." This might be one of those things where we have it 50 years later, and but who knows? I'll give it to him. He became their first martyr, and his body was displayed for all to see, for everyone to get mad at the murder. It wasn't like I put his head on a pike so everyone doesn't want to fight.
Instead, it was the opposite. At how they did our boy.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
In the Marge Simpson voice.
Yeah.
The Luddites smashed their way into the building. The defenders fled, and the Luddites went in and smashed everything up. I suspect that after they had just seen their friend shot, they probably were a little less particular in what they chose to sabotage. That same night, other Luddites attacked another shop and smashed up frames, in revenge for that shop hiring what are called colts, which were young men who hadn't been apprenticed, basically like old-timey scabbing or strike-breaking. A few days later, a cart full of looms was bandited by men who disguised their faces along the road, and then they, you know, smashed up the looms. That same day, 1,000 people poured into the town of Sutton, armed to the teeth, and smashed up all the machines in town. The militia came in. There's like no cops, basically, at this time. It's soldiers and militia that are doing all the law enforcement at scale. Mm-hmm. They came in and arrested about 12 people the next day. And this is actually one of the bigger arrests in the movement, but it didn't stop or slow down the movement in any appreciable way. It's at this point, it's November 1911, that they started sending letters out, communiques, if you will. All of them invoked Edward Ludd or Ned Ludd. Sometimes it was King Ludd. Sometimes it was General Ludd. Sometimes it was Captain in Chief Ned Ludd. And these letters are threats. The letters are stop treating workers as disposable, or we'll destroy your property, or maybe just kill you. It was quite literally terrorism.
Yeah.
They had no structural power over their bosses or the owning class, and they had no other means of recourse, but they had numbers, organization, secrecy, and the ability to instill fear. So that's what they did. They picked a leader, a fictitious one, and the first written version of that Ned Ludd kid I talked about last time comes from 1811, which was like 30 years after it supposedly had happened. So we don't know if this is actually the origin. One historian, Kirkpatrick Sale, makes the case that it could be derived from local slang that sent all of a Ludd meant to smash something into a heap, or that it could derive from an actual king from 1825 named King Ludd, or, you'll be shocked to know this is my favorite, it could also be connected to a King Lund of the first century BC, who is connected to the Celtic god Lud. And King Lund might be where the name London comes from. It might come from Lund's town, but other people make, the etymology is out. People
when you're getting shit that old, it's usually like, this is one of our better guesses.
Yeah. And it used to be, the best I can tell, it used to be a little bit more like, oh yeah, it's Lund's town. Totally. It's from, it's from King Lund. Mm-hmm. And then like now people are a little bit, it's like, oh, it's from the Proto-Indo-European word for like a low lying area or whatever. Sure. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But I like it when the Luddites get their name from the Celtic god Lud. That obviously is my favorite. All over, they are, you could say, soliciting financial support for their movement. Other people could say they're extorting it. I think both would be perfectly accurate representations. They would leave notes around that said things like, "Gentlemen all, Ned Ludd's compliments and hopes you will give a trifle towards supporting his army, as he well understands the art of breaking obnoxious frames. If you comply with this, it will be well. If not, I shall call upon you myself."
I love that. Again, very classy.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, they're starting to Robin Hood shit too. They are raiding wealthy farms for food and money. And they decided that they were better than Robin Hood soon enough. An unknown author coined a famous rhyme about them. "Chant no more your old rhymes about bold Robin Hood. His feats I but little admire. I will sing the achievements of General Lud, now the hero of Nottinghamshire." Sometimes they worked alone. Sometimes they worked in huge formations. And there's one problem with running around doing terrorism.
Oh, is there really? Now, this is something new. I've never heard of any problems with terrorism, Magpie.
Yeah, well, it turns out that Britain is a particularly law and order focused country.
Interesting.
Only at the time.
Interesting.
For a little brief period.
I may have to change some of my vacation plans.
Yeah, it's a good idea. Mm-hmm. There are about 200 capital offenses on the books in 1811, including like stealing cheap boots or writing threatening letters. Also, being a guy who has sex with another guy. Capital crime at the time. 10% of all criminals who were sentenced in England in 1810 were sentenced to death.
Jesus Christ.
Like, Texas, get your shit together. You got to catch up.
Yeah.
The rest of Europe was like, the rest of Europe wasn't really, they had the death penalty, but they were like looking over at England being like, y'all all right?
Fuck yeah, the fuck is happening here?
Yeah. So England responded to the Luddites by basically being like, fuck this, fuck them, fuck our own peasants. Let's just kill the lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
They pulled thousands of troops out of the Napoleonic Wars to put down the revolt. And this is the largest force used to put down a disturbance in English history up to that point. Although I've read that in multiple places. I would argue the English Civil War was like probably bigger and a disturbance, but whatever. I guess since the Civil War like won, it's like different. I don't know, whatever.
Yeah.
Nottingham was under siege by troops. Anyone who turned informant would be pardoned and massive rewards were offered for information. Supposed ringleaders were rounded up and a dozen people were arrested. But no one turned informant. None of the arrested turned snitch. Almost everyone was released for lack of evidence. And none of it stopped the raids because they hadn't actually caught. It's the thing that we keep running over time and time again. The hierarchical organization is like, haha, we have cut off the head of the snake. And then they're like, oh, shit, it's a jellyfish.
Yeah. No one's in charge. We're all just pissed.
Yeah. In the end, a few people did come forward to claim the reward for information. All of them were scamming the government. None of their lies held up in any court case. They just showed up with random ass information.
Based.
Which is a sketchy tactic that could get people hanged.
Mm-hmm.
But it worked. So fuck it. The government at the time wrote basically being like, oh, they must have an absolute hierarchy in order to have this much organization. Historians are pretty sure that they had the opposite thing working to their advantage. In some ways, they are quite formal. They're drilling out on the moors at night and they're sending representatives back and forth to coordinate between different groups sometimes. And soon enough, they'll be taking oaths of secrecy into the society. But it's very decentralized and there's no evidence of any kind of steering committee. Some owners started to give in to the Luddites and started promising to stop wage cuts and stop churning out mediocre hosiery. And this time period sometimes gets called collective bargaining by riot.
Hey, now that sounds like they're on to something here. I can get on board.
It worked and didn't, you know? It's like one of those things where it's like everything does or doesn't work. You know, people are like, oh, this one thing didn't work that one time. And you're like, yeah, you know what? Doesn't work most of the time, most things.
Yeah.
But the new year, 1812, dawned. Nottingham is under martial law. And this doesn't stop the antics. A man in a goatskin mask with a beard down to his waist, like waylays a cart full of frames in broad daylight and gets away with it. And no one can track him down.
The magic of goats.
Which is impressive because, I mean, yeah, like the god Pan has now robbed you, but how do you the man had a beard down to his waist.
That was a lot. I've been some places in the world where it's like, well, that has not narrowed it down at all. You know, we're in this village in like rural Iraq. There's a lot of men with beards down to their waists.
Fair enough. Yeah. And I want to know what the goat skin mask was. I want to know more about that. Did it look like a goat or was it just a bandana or was it, who knows? On Valentine's Day, 1812, the government, as a love letter to the common people, passed a new law. Death penalty for anyone who's caught breaking a frame.
Okay.
During the debates in the House of Lords, a young new baron in the House of Lords went up and gave a speech, and it is his first speech before the House, and it is a defense of the Luddites. He is the lone voice speaking out in defense of the Luddites. And his name is Lord Byron. The first vampire.
There we go. Yes.
He is more famous as a romantic poet than being the first vampire and for being friends with the Shelleys and the father of Ada Lovelace, who is probably the first computer programmer. But I'm going to tell you about how he's the first vampire. Have you heard this story?
Yeah, bits of it. Yes.
Okay. Well, I'm going to tell it to you again anyway. There's this famous ghost story competition that happens in Switzerland where Percy Shelley, Mary Shelley, and Lord Byron are the only three people there. That part's not true.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a ghost story competition. And this is where Frankenstein comes from, right? And yeah. Percy Shelley and Lord Byron wrote some like forgettable stuff. What Lord Byron told was like not technically a vampire story, but not a vampire story. It like could have been a vampire story. But there was another person there. There's probably a bunch more people there. There's probably servants there all over the place. But there's this like hanger on who is in the employ of Lord Byron, John Polidori. And the two men might have been fucking. Lord Byron was absolutely bisexual, which is actually part of why he left England, is that that was a capital crime.
Mm-hmm.
Whether just as friend or employer or lover, Lord Byron was a shit to John Polidori. He's like constantly like making fun of him and shit. Mm-hmm. And is basically like, oh, this drag of a guy I got to keep around me.
Yeah, it's like the pickup artists always say, negging is the best way to hit on someone.
I know. Lord Byron's the expert at this.
It works great on him.
Yeah. But the other thing is that every single historian is like, John Polidori sucked and was annoying as hell. But I'm like, was he or was he in an abusive relationship with Lord Byron? I don't know. Whatever happened, John wrote a story called The Vampire. And this is the creation of the vampire as a romantic character in Western literature. Prior to this, the vampire is an Eastern European folklore creature that is like not incredibly distinct from a zombie or a ghost or something. You know, it's like someone has come back from the dead, but it's not an aristocratic romantic character. So Lord Ruthven, the vampire in the story, the vampire, is absolutely a parody of Lord Byron. And it is this heartbreaking story about kind of being attached to and traveling with this guy who's just seducing women everywhere and sucks. Mm-hmm. And to make things worse, so Lord Byron's the first vampire and John Polidori is like, oh, I wish I could like have my own career, but I'm attached to this rich man or whatever, right? A magazine found his story and published it under the name Lord Byron. And so he just like can't exist in his own world.
Yeah. Yeah, we talked about this during our Dracula episodes.
Oh,
yeah.
Shit. Okay, yeah.
But
yeah.
Without this much detail, I didn't really get into anything about like their relationship.
Yeah.
Which is such a fucked up thing to have happen.
Yeah. And then like a couple years after this, John Polidori probably kills himself at a pretty young age.
Yeah.
It's like he died of accidental poisoning, but most people are like, yeah, he killed himself. That is like more, the gay love affair thing is like conjecture, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's funny to me to realize that the modern vampire might exist because of a salty gay love affair.
Yeah.
So what I'm telling you is that the Luddite's primary supporter in government, oh, actually before that, I should do an ad.
Our primary supporter is not the government.
Is all of these ads.
These guys.
Yeah.
Live Nation presents Concert Week. Now through May 14th, get $25 tickets to over 5,000 shows. That's up to 75% off a summer full of your favorite artists, like 21 Savage, Alanis Morissette, Cage the Elephant, Celeste Barber, Dierks Bentley, Fade, Hootie and the Blowfish, Janet Jackson, Kidz Bop Kids, Meghan Trainor, Pistol Puma, Sarah McLachlan. Get tickets to more than 5,000 summer shows for just $25. Until now through May 14th. Visit LiveNation.com/Concert Week to learn more and plan your summer with Sean Paul, Sum 41, 30 Seconds to Mars, oh, and Two Door Cinema Club.
Hi, I'm Cindy Crawford, and I'm the founder of Meaningful Beauty. When Dr. Sabah and I decided to do a skincare line together, he said to me, we are going to give women meaningful beauty. And I said, that's exactly right. We want to give women meaningful beauty, which means each and every product is meaningful. It has a reason to exist. It's efficacious. You're going to get results. And then you just go out and live your life.
Meaningful beauty. Confidence is beautiful. Learn more at meaningfulbeauty.com.
Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this, I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered. for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
And we're back. The Luddite's primary supporter in government was the first vampire. And his speech went hard. I don't know, he might have been a terrible person, he might have been a perfectly fine person, and John sucked, I don't know. But he was a good writer. He wrote, or said, "Is there not blood enough upon your penal code that more must be poured forth to ascend to heaven and testify against you? How will you carry the bill into effect? Can you commit a whole country to their own prisons? Will you erect a gibbet in every field and hang men up like scarecrows?" And the answer is like, yes. They're like, yeah.
Yes, that's exactly what I'll do.
Yeah, we're England. He stood alone in the House of Lords against the law, and it soon passed. And frankly, he stood alone against one of the greatest blows against the world ever passed by law, because it was one of the landmark laws in the Industrial Revolution, protecting the Industrial Revolution from anyone who is discontented about the way that revolution was going. The consequences of which have been a disaster for the human race. Mm-hmm. The law was the beginning of the end of the Luddites, but it didn't stop them. Like, the beginning of the end, it actually was the beginning of them going like twice as hard, honestly. It hardened them. Many of them had thought the government was there to protect them, like we were talking about earlier. Oh, the crown's on our side, even if the business people aren't. This is when they're like, oh, the crown exists to protect capital. So between martial law and occupation, and then soon a trial of some young Luddites happens, it puts a damper on activities in Nottingham. So then it just springs up in multiple other places immediately. Mm-hmm. Lancashire and Yorkshire are like, all right, let's fucking go. And they went even harder. Raids become more and more frequent despite attempts to stop them. In Yorkshire, they're stockpiling arms that they're like robbing from militias and from houses of rich people. They're more violent, they're more disciplined, and they're more likely to perceive themselves as a revolutionary force. Mm-hmm. They add a solemn oath to the mix, and to join the movement is to be twisted in, because these are like wool spinners and shit, right?
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, fiber is spun into yarn.
Yeah, that's good.
The oath was a far more poetic and long-winded way of saying, if I snitch, someone should kill me. Mm-hmm. They've got secret signals and like hand gestures. They have a call and response, and the call and response is, what are you? Determined. What for? Free liberty. And the government is like, hey, this is an insurrection. And they're right. Mm-hmm. They call themselves the Army of Redressers sometimes, and they are genuinely building towards a revolution. At least many of them saw themselves this way. Not necessarily everyone involved, but this is, I mean, that's true of every revolution, honestly.
Yeah.
They were in connection with quote, the Papists in Ireland. They were building ties with Scotland and France. They were doing what a lot of different people who are mad at the English government do, which is like, yo, France, you want to invade? Could you invade real quick?
Yeah.
And they were putting out explicit calls to end the monarchy and usher in a republic. At the core of it, they're mad because they're starving.
Right.
They are barely able to find work. They're subsisting off of oatmeal and like a scarce potato here and there. And they're watching people, especially infants, die of malnutrition.
Yeah, that would make me unhappy. I would be miffed.
Yeah, a little bit upset.
Yeah.
I might write a strongly worded letter.
Oh, yeah. I would be writing letters 2 or 3 times a week.
Yeah. And these people were too. They just, the strong words were a little stronger and they had something behind them.
Yeah.
And I think one thing that's hard for the modern European left to understand about the Luddites is that these workers were fighting for tradition against the Industrial Revolution. They were fighting for cultural lifeways. So they weren't revolutionaries in a certain context, right? They were fighting for the preservation of an existent or a previous way of life.
Yeah.
There were utopian dreamers among them, but it was a utopianism based on the foundations of their actual lifeways and culture, and is a vibe more familiar to leftists and radicals who come from outside the imperial core, is what I would argue.
Sure.
It also is part of why the right wing tries to claim this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. At this point, they add arson to their toolbox. On January 19th, 1812, they burn down a mill with no one inside, and soon they burn an awful lot more. And at this point, none of them, even when they're running around with axes and swords and shit, none of them are killing people on purpose at this point. And I think actually they haven't killed anyone at this point. A lot of them have died.
Mm-hmm.
One of the more notable Luddites was, of the more militant variety, was this man named George Meller, who was 24 in 1812. And he was a veteran of the Napoleonic Wars. And Robert, I don't know if you knew about this thing that I learned about from you years mm-hmm. ago from one of your podcasts about how when you go train soldiers to go fight wars overseas, they can come back and become revolutionaries.
Yeah, it turns out if you make people really good at fighting and then they get angry at you, you have a problem.
Yeah. And that's the Luddites, especially once you get up into Yorkshire. So this veteran of the Napoleonic Wars, he and presumably other veterans gave the Luddites their military structure and tactics. And he was a cropper. Basically, he cut cloth for a living, which is a very physically demanding job. And croppers were famously large, strong, and fighty. He had apprenticed for 7 years at this job, and not that many people could do this job, so it paid comparatively well. New shearing frames were putting them out of work very quickly, and soon he'd be lucky to just work in some factory somewhere if he found a job at all.
Sure.
So in 1812, in April 1812, George Meller and more than 100 of his closest friends armed themselves with everything from guns to rocks and everything in between, and they marched on a mill called the Rawfolds Mill, owned by a Mr. Cartwright. Some of the men carried huge sledgehammers called Enoch. Like, they'd be like, make way for Enoch when some hammering needed to happen. And they were called this because the maker of the hammers, which they use for work, was a guy named Enoch. And he's like not on their side. He also makes a bunch of the machines. It's just like his design.
Mm-hmm.
But they're Luddites. So of course they're aware of and making reference to biblical forces when they say all this shit. Enoch is a guy who lived for 365 years and walked into heaven alive rather than waiting to die.
Pretty based.
Yeah. So they storm this mill, but it's not empty. Mr. Cartwright and nine others, with four loyal workers and five soldiers from the local militia, they're inside. And they've, like, defended, they've like, built everything to have little pulleys that pull up things to block things and reinforce the door and all this shit.
Mm-hmm.
And the defenders open fire. And they're like, bring forth Enoch! And Enoch, you know, runs to the front and starts to batter down the door, which is heavily reinforced. It takes a very long time for them to break through. And now we get to my favorite named character in the whole story, with my favorite line in the whole story. A young apprentice named John Booth, forever known to history as not the other John Booth, this is the good John Booth.
Mm-hmm.
He did not shoot Abraham Lincoln. Instead, he himself got shot.
I love it when people don't shoot Abraham Lincoln. One of my favorite things for people to do is not shoot Abraham Lincoln.
I know. Almost everyone in the world has succeeded at that.
Yeah, the vast majority of people, even Elon Musk, as far as I know, has not shot Abraham Lincoln. Now, would he have? Maybe, perhaps. Yeah,
does he probably have a secret machine to build a time machine to go back and shoot Abraham Lincoln sooner so that he can have apartheid last longer in South Africa?
Who can say?
I can't legally say.
Mm-hmm. I can't prove it yet.
But the good John Booth, he takes a musket ball to the leg and he goes down.
Mm-hmm.
And soon enough, a blacksmith is shot too. And the alarm bell is ringing, and the literal cavalry is on its way. And so the Luddites retreat, and they're like, there's like tearful goodbyes where they're like, I don't think we can take you with us, but remember your oath. Okay, bud. Okay, good luck. Bye, friend. And they like leave tearfully. They leave two wounded, dying comrades. There's no time to drag them away. Both men were interrogated. Neither gave anything up. And it might be apocryphal, but it's my favorite last words in history. The interrogator, possibly the local priest, who is a super anti-Luddite guy, is like, all right, tell us what you know. Give us some names. John Booth looks up and says, can you keep a secret? And the priest is like, of course. John Booth says, so can I.
God, that's cool.
Yeah. And then John
Booth died.
I love
stuff like that too, where it's like they could have stopped anyone from learning about his last words, but it was just too cool to not. Even as the guys who killed him, you're like, well, but we got to tell people. That was just too badass.
I know. Or like they were like, can you believe the recalcitrance of these stupid, you know, whatever. But yeah, no, exactly. And John Booth dies on the operating table as they're amputating his leg. This is not a good time to get shot in the leg.
Yeah, no. Not like today. Today's really a golden age for getting shot in the leg.
I'll tell you, of any year that has happened,
yeah.
If I were to pick a year to get shot in the leg,
it'd probably become
15 years ago or something.
If you become unstuck in time like Billy Pilgrim and you're planning on getting shot in the leg at some point, now is definitely the destination.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the soldiers inside the mill refused to shoot on the crowd. When he's ordered to, he puts down his gun and says he can't shoot upon his brothers. And he is court-martialed. And then, because of all of English history is one tiny town, and I'm going to tie three more literary figures.
There have only been 30 people in English history.
Yeah. At least that wrote things that got remembered. There's another reverend in the town, and this one's not anti-Luddite. He's an Irish Anglican guy. I don't think he's like pro them specifically, but he's like neutral or whatever. And he sees people sneaking into the church's graveyard at night to secretly bury two Luddites who'd been killed in the raid, whose names are lost to history. And he didn't say anything to anyone about it because no one should be punished for performing a Christian burial. That guy's name was Reverend Patrick Bronte, only famous to history because his three daughters are the fucking Bronte sisters who wrote like everything.
Mm-hmm.
The guy Cartwright, the mill owner, is hated by Luddites. Every door after this happens, after these people are killed, has vengeance for the blood of the innocent chalked on it one morning after the death of good John Booth and the others.
Based.
And it's this interesting thing where I think the people, the Luddites, genuinely believe that they have been wronged for being shot while they're trying to destroy things with axes and hammers, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Which sounds almost silly now, but like in retrospect, you're like, well, probably you shouldn't shoot people for destroying property. That's...
Yeah.
The Luddites, for the first time, they're planning specific and actual violence. When Cartwright was leaving town, he'd been in town testifying at the court-martial of the soldier. He wasn't like, oh, I understand, my boy. He was like, fuck you. You didn't fucking shoot people. Some folks from the bushes tried to shoot him, but missed. And no one knows for sure whether that was like trying to kill him or was like warning shots to be like, get the fuck out of here. But they were probably trying to kill him. Around this time, they develop a new tactic. Food riots. Food riots start breaking out everywhere. A lot of historians discount them from the story of the Luddites. And I think that's because of misogyny. Because it's mostly men doing the raids at night. And it is mostly women leading and participating in the food riots and being hanged for it. At least two of these women called themselves Lady Ludd while leading these fucking food riots. And people are like, does this really count? I don't know. The prices of basic foods were skyrocketing. One woman named Hannah Smith, she was 54. She was hanged for handing out potatoes to a crowd from a cart she commandeered. They called it highway robbery in order to hang her. And food riots turned into rob the militias and steal their guns riots. And soon the overall tactic of the Luddites was to start with a food riot and then move into attacks on factories and mansions. Two men in dresses led a riotous crowd to a factory owner's mansion, and then everyone like broke out the windows of the place with rocks. And this is the only known for certain time that crossdressers were involved, but it is the symbol of the movement for generations to come, is to have like kind of like a big, strong man with a sledgehammer wearing a dress. And what's interesting about it is that the historians who like the Luddites tend to downplay the cross-dressing, whereas those who like want to accuse it of being like silly and a fight against modernity and annoying play up the cross-dressing. But even the downplayers are like, well, there might have been more articles of women's clothing like here and there among the rest of the raids. I don't know, you know. This was a common method of disguise and more like carnival that was part of rebellions in England and Ireland at this point. It comes from this sort of world turned upside down thing that happens at festivals, which is the like someone's king for a day, or, you know, the lay people are the priests and the priests are the lay people, this kind of thing. And often the Luddites will claim themselves as General Ludd's wives. And I, of course, you'll be shocked to know, think it's really cool that they were all a bunch of weird cross-dressers.
Yes. That is like, that's also just a thing the English do a lot. I mean, like, yeah. We all know our Monty Python. There's like a long and complicated history of cross-dressing, specifically in the UK.
Yep. But what there isn't a complicated history of in the UK is advertisement, because if you're listening to this in the UK, all of the sponsors are good and moral and helpful.
Yeah, we're entirely sponsored by the British royal family.
That's right.
Yeah, so check that out. You know, the British royal family is such a good deal that you're about to get like two or three monarchs in the space of just a couple of years. So really, you know, constantly working on that value.
Yeah. And remember to use the promo code
Sausage Fingers.
People. Here are the ads.
Live Nation presents Concert Week. Now through May 14th, get $25 tickets to over 5,000 shows. That's up to 75% off a summer full of your favorite artists, like 21 Savage, Alanis Morissette, Cage the Elephant, Celeste Barber, Dierks Bentley, Fade, Hootie and the Blowfish, Janet Jackson, Kidz Bop Kids, Meghan Trainor, Pistol Pluma, Sarah McLachlan. Get tickets to more than 5,000 summer shows for just $25. Until now through May 14th. Visit LiveNation.com/Concert Week to learn more and plan your summer with Sean Paul, Sum 41, 30 Seconds to Mars, oh, and Two Door Cinema Club.
Hi, I'm Cindy Crawford, and I'm the founder of Meaningful Beauty. Well, I don't know about you, but, like, I never liked being told, oh, wow, you look so good for your age. Like, why even bother saying that? Why don't you just say you look great at any age, every age? That's what Meaningful Beauty is all about. We create products that make you feel confident in your skin at the age you are now.
Meaningful Beauty. Beautiful skin at every age. Learn more at meaningfulbeauty.com.
Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this, I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered. For just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
And we're back. Okay, so another time, 5 Luddites are killed and 18 injured when thousands of women and men storm a factory and were met with rifle fire. So you're moving towards these like daytime raids, these like larger mass actions. And it's around this point when even the misogynists have to admit women were heavily involved in the movement.
Yeah.
The crowds get larger and larger, the attacks get more brazen, and the persecution becomes more deadly. And these crowds would march with a straw dummy held aloft, which represented Ned Ludd. And they flew a fucking red flag, the flag of revolt, which is way older than state socialism.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And as many as 30 people were killed one day in an attack on one owner's mansion. They were met with sword and rifle from cavalry. And they're still at this point rarely shooting back. Their goal isn't violence, not directly, but intimidation and destruction. It's around this point that spies are starting to successfully get into the movement, at least 9 of them. Mm-hmm. And around 1 or 2 of the arrestees were starting to talk, but really very, very few in the end. The government, not particularly fond of being overthrown, just put thousands of soldiers into these tiny areas, mm-hmm. like 14,000 soldiers. I've read somewhere that 1 in 70 people in the entire triangle was a soldier.
Gee, many. Christmas.
The rewards kept getting raised higher and higher. At some point, they're offering £2,000, which is literally a lifetime's wages, is 40 years of wages at the like decent previous artisan rate. No one takes it. The occupying force was rather rude, to say the least. There weren't enough barracks, and they were all housed in like local pubs and just kind of like took over these towns. And then at the end of April, they entered their final phase, where most movements that don't succeed go. When most movements that don't become widespread popular revolt across the entire country.
Yeah, but don't become a government, right? Yeah.
Some of them turn to reform, because the government started promising, like, oh, we'll like look into some stuff. And some of them, because of the repression, turned to increasingly isolated acts of armed insurrection, violence, expropriation, and assassination in the name of outright revolution. One owner had picked the wrong name for his family. His name was Horsefall. And he said he wanted to ride his horse up to the saddle in Luddite blood. He really didn't like the Luddites very much.
Mm-hmm.
And he was so famous for saying this shit that little kids, like local kids in the area, would like run in front of his horse and be like, I'm General Ludd. What are you going to do? You know?
Oh, boy. Brave kids.
I know. Like, they're not quite old enough for the factory job. Just kidding. They're old enough for the factory jobs. Melor, that veteran of the Napoleonic Wars, he has it out for this particular owner, for Horsefall. He once says that he saw an infant die at its mother's breast while Melor like rode by uncaring. He like holds, in his version of the story, I think it's like he like holds the dead baby up to Melor, who's like, I don't even give a shit, fuck you, you know? I don't really believe that story. It's too pat, but it might have happened. I don't know. He doesn't like Horsefall. So him and three of his buds waylaid Horsefall and shot him to death, and he fell off his horse. And what he said as he fell was not poetic, but it was definitely accurate. He shouted, murder!
Well, okay. Yeah.
He didn't die right away. He died 36 hours later. His last words were, these are awful times, doctor. And it's like kind of, I'm like,
yeah.
I get some empathy there, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And the revolutionists are robbing mansions for guns for a revolution that doesn't happen. The reformists are failing to get basic watered down reforms pushed through the House of Lords. Like the House of Commons will like take their demands and water them down extensively and then put them to the House of Lords, who are like, we don't give a shit. We're the House of Lords. Only Lord Byron is on their side in the House of Lords. And it just loses steam in the face of military occupation and repression. Also, the comet's gone. It's largely seen as a movement that failed, and that is mostly true. It did not win lasting reforms. It did not stop the Industrial Revolution. To be fair, no one else did either. But strategically, it was actually kind of interestingly a stalemate. The government wanted to kill a lot of them, wanted to convict and kill or deport just so many people. They had a massive occupation of the area. They only managed to get a couple dozen convictions in the end. This with this army. And they managed to send some Luddites to Australia and they hanged others. But for all their spies and the astronomically high bounties, the Crown couldn't get many arrests. And those they arrested, they couldn't get too many convictions. Because this is the thing that the Luddites were best at. They shut the fuck up.
Yeah.
That is the whole secret. Many, many more of them would have died. You had thousands and thousands of people committing capital offenses. No one talked. So not everyone walked, but most people did. Thousands of lives saved. They kept their mouths shut for decades after. It wasn't until the end of the 19th century that people started talking about the wild shit they'd done in their youth. Mm-hmm. It was also successful that it cemented the Luddite name into history. Though, of course, the powers of culture and control have done an amazing job of turning it into a byword for doesn't understand how to program a VCR, which shows how old I am.
Mm-hmm.
But what I could mean part of a seriously amazing armed insurrection that, like, it is 72 degrees in early March in the mountains while I'm recording this. If the Luddites had succeeded, it might not be.
Yeah. And we could still have clothing.
I know. Because yeah. They weren't trying to get rid of the idea of automating anything.
Yeah.
If they had been like, hey, y'all, we're going to automate a lot of your jobs. Here is a living wage. Or here is like other ways to express your artistic craft. Or like, here's some, you know, or like, you're the one who can operate this machine. Don't worry. Here's a pension. Like, could have been fine. But I will end with one more quote from Queen Maeve, that poem by Percy Shelley. Just a bit of the utopian imagining. Because this is after the Luddite Rebellion. This poem comes out, and it is the Bible of the working class for multiple generations. A brighter morn awaits the human day, when every transfer of Earth's natural gifts shall be a commerce of good words and works, When poverty and wealth, the thirst of fame, the fear of infamy, disease and woe, war with its million horrors and fierce hell shall live but in the memory of time.
Wow.
Them's the Luddites.
Yeah. Well, maybe take some lessons out of this, folks. Because we're going to need to do something about this whole 72 degrees in March in the mountains.
Yeah.
Bit.
You know, and some of the other lessons you can take out of it are like, well, sometimes things work and sometimes things don't. And
sure,
just because something's the more militant doesn't make it right. And sometimes because things the more reformist, it doesn't make it right. And
mm-hmm.
it takes all of us trying different things, you know?
Yeah.
And what it also takes is a pivot to plugs.
Yeah, sure. Read my book, After the Revolution.
Oh, good point.
Which is about the aftermath of a successful revolution. And shit's still fucked up, as it always is. But now there's a big rolling city, so that's pretty cool. There's some good
stuff. That is what I like about the book After the Revolution. People haven't read it. They should go out and read it. It's like, oh, we had a revolution, and it didn't fix everything. And yeah, some things are more interesting, and some things are worse, and some things are better, and some things would have been worse anyway. And like, I appreciate that it's a little bit more honest. Like, I like this utopian imagining, this poem I'm closing with, Shelley being like, oh, you know, we'll be a time without war and disease and poverty, and like, no one will be poor and no one will be rich. And that's like, cool. And I'm all about that. But it's also not how it's going to go.
Yeah.
You know?
No.
Like, that's the one thing. That's the Margaret Killjoy promise.
Yeah, you gotta. I mean, one of the things that Roddenberry got right is that you don't get any steps towards utopia without some disasters along the way. And then one thing the people who eventually took the series from him got right is that maintaining utopia is also a constant battle.
Yeah,
things just aren't nice forever.
Yeah, I've been on a Star Trek kick lately too. I've been really into the way that people have picked up the ball and run with it and been like, oh, maybe the Federation isn't perfect, and like, but what is perfect is I have another podcast called Live Like the World Is Dying, which comes out every Friday, and I'm one of three hosts, and we talk about how to navigate living in bad times. And also, Sophie, what do you got?
Subscribe to Cooler Zone Media on Apple. Android version coming soon. Look out for that.
Yeah.
All right.
In the near future, check out Margaret's baking cookbook, Live Like the World Is Pieing.
Oh my God.
That's all I got.
If it was a Margaret cookbook, it would literally just be how to make hardtack. Everyone, this is my final plug. Everyone make hardtack. If you eat it, you'll break your teeth, but it lasts forever if you keep it away from moisture, light, and heat. So hardtack, it's the way you turn your flour into non-dour times. Bye.
Cool People Who Did Cool Stuff is a production of Cool Zone Media. For more podcasts from Cool Zone Media, visit our website, coolzonemedia.com, or check us out on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Live Nation presents Concert Week. Now through May 14th, get $25 tickets to over 5,000 shows. That's up to 75% off a summer full of your favorite artists, like 21 Savage, Alanis Morissette, Cage the Elephant, Celeste Barber, Dierks Bentley, Fade, Hootie and the Blowfish, Janet Jackson, Kidz Bop Kids, Meghan Trainor, Pistol Puma, Sarah McLachlan. Get tickets to more than 5,000 summer shows for just $25. Until now through May 14th. Visit LiveNation.com/Concert Week to learn more and plan your summer with Sean Paul, Sum 41, 30 Seconds to Mars, and Two Door Cinema Club.
This is Raquel Willis from Queer Chronicles. Right now, there are close to 500 anti-LGBTQ plus bills in state legislatures across the country. Lambda Legal is leading the charge against these hateful bills that target mostly trans and non-binary people. You can fight discrimination and help write the next chapter of Lambda Legal history. To learn more about their open cases and to donate, visit lambdalegal.org. That's lambdalegal.org.
I'm so excited to tell you JCPenney and country music singer-songwriter Walker Hayes are partnering together on a new limited-time men's collection for the everyday guy. What I love about Walker Hayes is his laid-back nature. He's a family man, and being a country megastar while also having 7 kids, you know he likes to keep his style cool and casual. This new collection is perfect for the guy living the t-shirt life or someone wanting some fresh options that feel just as good. It's easy to wear, affordable styles that celebrate the ultimate family man, along with the quality, durability, and sensibility dads appreciate. Available online Saturday, May 4th at jcp.com and in-store Thursday, May 16th. Just in time for Father's Day. Limited time only. JCPenney, make it count.